Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. Tonight, our guest, Edward Haslam, Dr. Mary's Monkey, an unsolved murder of a doctor back in 1964. What could that possibly have to do with Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and an emerging global epidemic? We've kind of discussed in the first hour who Dr. Mary Sherman was, but why did people want her dead, Ed? Why was she targeted? What was the idea behind getting rid of Dr. Mary Sherman?
Well, Dave, there's a whole lot easier ways to kill people than burn off their arms.
Right.
You know, so I'm not sure if she was really the target or if the laboratory itself was the target. Because if Dr. Alton Ochsner had grabbed the handle that Mary Sherman grabbed and his arm had been burned off, they would not have been able to drag him back to his apartment and call it a sex slashing. They got away with that because Mary Sherman was female. She was from out of town. She did not have local family. And they could say what they wanted to say about it. And they did not tell the public what really happened. And that's why I'm certain about this being a cover-up from day one, because I've got the 2 weeks' worth of newspaper coverage. And it's only in the last paragraph of the last article that appeared that they even mentioned that some of the flesh had been burned away from her arm. I mean, this is not some of the flesh. The bone's gone. You know, I mean, everything up to her shoulder is disintegrated. Her rib cage is disintegrated. You know, so what happened, if they had a world-class scientist laying on the floor with her arm burned off, okay, if they had done the normal thing, called 9/11, it would have called all the attention to this facility that was like a medical Manhattan Project. They didn't want to expose this because the moment you expose it, you say, what's that machine? Oh, radiation. And why do you have a radioactive piece of equipment here on the back of the U.S. Public Health Service? Oh, you're mutating monkey viruses. Why are you mutating monkey viruses? And that gets us back to our story here, because once I was telling you about the antibiotics, okay? The people who made the antibiotics, you know, they knew it was the most important discovery in the history of medicine, okay? It was also the most profitable. And if the antibiotics was leading to the polio, then that the polio threatened the use of antibiotics. They had to get rid of polio. So this whole hysteria that happens in the 1950s over polio, it's stalking you, it's going to kill your children, blah, 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 all that stuff is intended to justify the polio vaccine to make the world safe for antibiotics, okay? And that's the part of the story we were not told. And so they were in a huge hurry to get the polio vaccine developed. And polio, the virus, loves monkey kidney cells. So they were growing the 200 million doses of the polio vaccine on monkey kidney cells from the rhesus monkey, both the Salk and Sabin vaccines. And you know, we can talk a little bit about that. And in fact, when they had a big press conference in April of 1955 up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the March of Dimes people were there, and they brought in all their PR people from New York, and they put on this big show in Ann Arbor, Michigan, saying that the field trials were successful. That means the tests they did on the children before it was approved. Those were called field trials, okay? The field trials were successful. This thing is safe. It is effective. Roll up your sleeves because you're about to get a vaccination, all right? And then after they had told that to the public through the media, then they turned to Bernice Eddy, MD, PhD, who was the official vaccine safety tester for the federal government, and said, Dr. Eddy, time for you to approve the vaccine. And she takes the vaccine back and injects it into her monkeys, and she gets back dead and crippled monkeys. And she says, guys, there's a problem with this vaccine. I don't know what it is right now, but I've got sick monkeys here from your vaccine. And it's all coming out of one batch, and that's the cutter batch, and you need to withdraw this batch. Well, it turns out the major stockholder in Cutter Laboratories is Dr. Alton Ochsner from New Orleans, Mary Sherman's boss. okay? And he says, I'm not withdrawing my batch. This thing is safe. And he was chief of surgery at Tulane Medical School at the time. So he calls the entire faculty of Tulane Medical School into the amphitheater, including my father and Mary Sherman, and he says, there's a controversy about the polio vaccine. And I want you to know that I've known Jonas Salk for 20 years. I'm closely involved with this. I've watched it every step of the way. And I'm here to tell you that this vaccine is safe. And I would never ask you to do anything that I would not be willing to do myself. So here are my grandchildren. And he injects his grandson and granddaughter in front of the faculty of Tulane Medical School. And in 48 hours, his grandson is dead and his granddaughter has polio.
Holy cow.
Now, so there's a problem, right? And I wish I had Jonas Salk's PR people working for me, because he walks away from this thing as a hero when his thing blew up on the launch pad. And he gets a plaque from President Eisenhower on the White House lawn. He gets to go to La Jolla, California, live out his life on the bluffs there in the Salk Institute and everything else. But his vaccine gets pulled after 2 weeks due to the Cutter incident. And it gets replaced about 9 months later with the Sabin vaccine. Now, Salk's, there's three flavors of polio, and this kind of is an important part of the story, so I need to take a minute on this. I'm going to call them heavy, medium, and light, all right? Heavy is the only one that kills or cripples, all right? So Salk said that's the only one you got to worry about. So let's take polio heavy, drown it in formaldehyde, and then we'll have a dead virus, without getting into the conversation about whether viruses are alive or not, but it's called the dead virus vaccine, okay? And we're going to inject your children with a dead virus. Their immune system will respond to it. And when the live virus shows up, your immune system will be ready to kill it. Remembering that the blood, the immune system in the blood, is only the second layer of defense in the intestines, or the real defense here. So Sabin says, why mess with polio heavy? I mean, that's the dangerous one. Don't mess with it. Polio light doesn't kill and cripple. Maybe flu-like symptoms, but it's way safer. So Sabin said, leave it alive and put it in the vaccine. Okay, so Sabin's vaccine, which begins with a syringe and eventually becomes the sugar cube vaccine, famous for in the 50s, in early 60s, Sabin's vaccine used polio light, but they both grew the polio on monkey kidney cells. Now, in 1957, right, the release is in 55. In 1957, two researchers at the National Institute of Health, they are Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart, discover a cancer-causing virus. They name it polyoma. Poly meaning many, oma meaning tumors. This one virus causes multiple types of cancer in multiple types of animals. It was the first time they had ever seen anything like that. The moment that was discovered, Congress starts throwing money at them. Buy your electron microscopes. Let's start cataloging these viruses that are in the monkeys, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what they discover is that polyoma is the 40th one they discover. So they call it SV40, simian virus number 40, or monkey virus number 40. They discovered that that is native to the Asian monkey that we know as the rhesus monkey. And medicine science loves the rhesus monkey because its blood is closest to human blood of all animals. So they use it a lot in medical research. And it was the rhesus monkey that they killed and cut out their kidneys and ground them up and put them in the petri dish to grow the polio vaccine. And when they took out the polio vaccine, they got all of the other monkey viruses that were in the monkey's kidneys, including SV40.
Unreal.
So, and they figured this out after they had released 100 million doses of the polio vaccine. This is the biggest mistake in history.
Let's take another break. Ed Haslam, our guest. Check out his website. Spell it out, drmarysmonkey.com. You'll find more information on Ed's book and how you can order autographed copies and read more about it. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this. The 1964 murder of a nationally known cancer researcher sets a stage for a gripping expose of medical professionals enmeshed in covert government operations over the course of three decades. Following a trail of police records, FBI files, cancer statistics, and medical journals, this revealing new book that's just been re-released with even more information, Dr. Mary's Monkey, covers all of the information, revealing evidence of a web of medical secrets keeping began with the handling of evidence in the JFK assassination and continued sweeping doctors into cover-ups of cancer outbreaks, contaminated polio vaccine, and the arrival of the AIDS virus. Our guest this evening is Ed Haslam. He's trying to shine some light on this subject. Share with us what's new in his research and why the re-release of the book. What could possibly be still coming to light? We're going to continue to find that out as the show progresses this evening. Ed, she's killed. Now, when I had asked before why her specifically, you said you weren't sure it was her that they were going for. It might have been the whole lab. It just happened to be that she was the one that got hit. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes.
Okay, but when they covered that up, why didn't they wipe everything else out at that time, realizing that they'd missed the main target of the entire thing? Was she just a casual bystander?
The machine was immediately removed.
Okay.
From the facility. They removed them, and the machine, this is a big gun that shoots a radioactive beam, right? And down at the base of it, they had a platinum pyramid. And the platinum pyramid split the beam into equal doses so they could, you know, put a bunch of test tubes around the thing and expose all the test tubes to the same amount of radiation at the same time and to see what happened. Okay, they pulled out the machine, they pulled out the platinum pyramid, you know, the control panels and all that stuff, but they left all the wiring, which is how we found the building. Okay, so was Mary Sherman actually the target? As I said, there are easier ways to kill people. You know, blowing off somebody's arm exposes the facility, okay? And that gets into who would want to expose the facility. And when did this happen? This just happens to happen on the day the Warren Commission comes to New Orleans to start its investigation into Lee Harvey Oswald. And they just happen to have on their desk ID cards for A.J. Heidel, Lee Oswald's alias. They came from the U.S. Public Health Service, okay? So this facility and the timing of it goes back. And what's this got to do with Oswald in the first place? Okay, we're about to find that out, all right? Because the question is, and before the break, we just talked about the contamination of the polio vaccine, and they didn't learn about it until they released 100 million doses. The question, put yourself in their shoes for a minute. What did they do once they knew? Well, the first thing you do is you stamp it secret, because you don't want to stand up in front of the congregation and just say, we just mass inoculated all your children with a cancer-causing virus. And this is now a national security secret, okay? And secondly, they got to get really busy on trying to develop a vaccine to stop it. And if you don't know that there are cancer-causing viruses, you don't have to worry about this. But if you're one of the doctors that knows that there are cancer-causing viruses, then you understand that you've got to use the virus to develop the vaccine. Now, the problem is, you remember I said polio had heavy, medium, and light. Here with SV40, they only have heavy. They've got to get that to mutate into something that's can be used as part of a vaccine so they can try to stop the approaching epidemic of cancer that they see. And so they use radiation to mutate the monkey viruses, okay, which is part of what got me started on this. Get back to your first question, which was, you know, we had people mutating monkey viruses, and we then had a global epidemic caused by a mutated monkey virus, right? So maybe somebody ought to be looking and see if there's any connection between these two. Now, let me say that SV40 is what's called a DNA virus. It's got DNA in it. And AIDS is not a DNA virus. AIDS does not have DNA in it. It only has RNA, okay, which is why it's called a retrovirus. And SIV, which is the ancestor virus to AIDS, is a retrovirus. It does not have DNA in it, okay? So I am not saying that SV40 caused AIDS. No, okay? But they were caging the monkeys together, the African monkeys and the Asian monkeys. And the monkeys were getting all cross-infected with each other's viruses. And when they got down to saying what's really in the polio vaccine and were able to look at all of the viruses, they realized that SIV was in there too. So, and this leads us to one of the propaganda things out there. I call it the near miss. People take a story that's almost true but easy to disprove, like AIDS was in the polio vaccine. AIDS was not in the polio vaccine. They know it. It's easy to disprove. But SIV, the ancestor to AIDS, was in the polio vaccine. And when you take a test tube of that stuff and stick it in front of a radioactive machine, you're going to hit both of the viruses. So one of the questions I have, and it's a question, but I think it's a fair question, is did this process of trying to mutate the monkey virus in this medical Manhattan project, did that lead to the mutation of SIV, which became HIV-1? I mean, I think it's a fair question. But what happens here is they set up this facility and they put a whole team together down in New Orleans in 1960-61, okay? They recruit Ochsner for this project in 59, all right? So there's Ochsner, who's a former president of the American Cancer Society and major stockholder in one of the polio labs, all right? So he understands this problem really well. Working for him is Mary Sherman, who's a world-class expert in both cancer and radiation.
Okay.
Then Mary Sherman went to the University of Chicago Medical School, and I get out the reference books and realize that she was a first-year medical student at the University of Chicago at the same time that Sarah Stewart was a first-year medical student at the University of Chicago. She and Sarah Stewart are best friends, and I get this confirmed by other doctors who knew both of them. So you've got the researcher who discovered the cancer-causing virus. You've got the expert in radiation and cancer. You've got the president of the American Cancer Society. And then they bring in an expert in experimental design who's been working on biowarfare weapons. His name is Jose Rivera. Now, let me tell you how we know he's there. Jose Rivera's background goes back to debriefing the Japanese scientists at the end of World War II during the MacArthur occupation. Then he goes to Fort Sam Houston in Texas. Then he goes to Fort Detrick up in Maryland, which everyone knows is a big bioweapons facility. And then he winds up as the director of neurology and blindness for the National Institute of Health. He's one of the directors of one of the institutes of health, okay? Between those last two assignments, Fort Detrick and NIH, we find him in New Orleans teaching introductory biology at Loyola University, which doesn't even have a graduate school. That's an awfully strange career move, and that's called a cover job because he happens to be 1 mile from the linear particle accelerator. And we know that because his name is in the faculty book, and he is kind of a notorious character. I talk about him in relationship to Adele Edison, who blew the whistle on him, basically. But so what you've got this going on is 60 and 61, all right? At that point in time, I think their objective is looking for a vaccine, trying to develop something to stop the cancer epidemic that they all fear.
And we've got to take a break. Let's come back and we'll continue on with the timeline to find out how this is breaking down. What are they trying to do? How are they trying to scramble to fix the mess that they've made? Dr. Mary's Monkey is the name of the book. Edward Haslam is our guest this evening. Got a lot more coming your way this evening on Coast to Coast. Our guest will be with us for the full 4 hours. We'll open up phone lines in the fourth hour if you have questions for our guest regarding this case. Stick with us. A lot more Coast to Coast AM coming your way right after this. Welcome back. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Edward Haslam, our guest. Dr. Mary's Monkey, an intriguing, twisted tale that involves the murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, cancer-causing monkey viruses, and links to Lee Harvey Oswald and the JFK assassination in an emerging global epidemic. Sound unbelievable? Too hard to believe? Stay tuned. We're going to continue finding out more about this story. Ed, continue on with our timeline here and keep walking us through this so we can try to follow along. It's so thick with things going on. I'm surprised you're able to keep it all straight.
Well, they discovered about the contamination of the polio vaccine in the late 1950s. By 1960 and 61, they were trying to do something about it by creating a vaccine to prevent the cancer epidemic that we have today. And this was during the Cold War, okay? And I lived in New Orleans at the time, and one of the things that happens right at the beginning of the 60s, of course, is Castro takes over Cuba, and you have the embargo. Well, the business in New Orleans is trade, has always been. Today it's tourism, but it's always been trade, okay? And the embargo, the Cuban embargo, knocked out 25% of the trade out of New Orleans. And Castro's talking about taking his revolution to the rest of Latin America. Well, if it goes to Central and South America, though, there go the coffee beans, and there go the bananas, and there go all the fresh food and stuff. So Castro is a real threat to the United States from the New Orleans perspective, certainly a threat to the New Orleans business community. And then in 1962, the Russian missiles start coming in. Or at least we find out about it in 62. They're actually in there a little earlier. But it's the Cuban Missile Crisis, the great drama that's played out in front of the television set, occurs in October 1962. And at that point in time, people are saying, this Castro guy's got to go. I mean, we can't have Russian nuclear missiles pointed at New Orleans, and they had a 600-mile range and a big circle, and New Orleans is right inside the circle. Okay, so, and I remember sitting there watching television, wondering if, you know, we were going to get nuked before the late movie came on, you know? And so it was a big issue in New Orleans, and they basically decided to take this project that nobody knew about, this Medical Manhattan Project, where they were using the radiation on the viruses and ramp it up to make a biological weapon so that they could kill Fidel Castro, or at least this is what the scientists involved were told was the motive for doing this harebrained scheme, okay? And this happens in 63, okay? The 62 is the missile crisis. They decide to get rid of Castro. And at this point, I need to introduce another player in this because I got a phone call from 60 Minutes, the CBS news show, and they said, we've been investigating for over a year now this woman who keeps telling us that she was the technician in the underground medical laboratory in New Orleans that you wrote about. And we'd like to open the conversation with you, okay? So they introduced me to Judy, all right? Now, Judy, in the 60s, was a high school kid in Florida who was doing cancer experiments and was giving cancer to mice in 7 days, which is faster than they were able to do it at NCI. Okay, so she's outperforming the entire cancer establishment in the United States from a dirt floor laboratory in Florida with no budget. Okay, the moment they find out about her, they scoop her up and they bring her up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Cancer Center, and they put her in Dr. Moore's lab. He's the guy that runs the whole thing, and they train her to handle cancer-causing viruses and to do exotic blood work that relates to determining if people have cancer or not. Then they set her up in a laboratory. Initially, it's in Indiana, but it winds up being down in Florida in Gainesville, where she's got access to radiation. She's got access to human cancer cells, and she's doing these experiments to find out if the radiation, like from an X-ray, will trigger the virus to start the cancer. This is a question they don't want to ask in public because it threatens the entire use of radiation in American medicine. And so they've got her doing these experiments in secret down at the University of Florida. They're paying her. Senator Smathers sets all this up where they're paying her tuition and room and board and all that stuff. And she's sending monthly reports into New Orleans to Dr. Ochsner about her research. Then in the spring of 63, Ochsner calls her and says, Judy, and she's a sophomore at this point in time in college, how'd you like to skip the last 2 years of college and start med school in the fall? We'll pay your room and board and tuition, and give you a stipend. And you, so you'll start. You could, you're wasting your time in college. We want you in medical school. There's just something we need you to do this summer, and it's very important to the country. You'll be doing the country a great big favor, and you'll be able to work with the world-class doctor, Dr. Mary Sherman, who runs my cancer lab. Would you like to do this, Judy? Well, I mean, this is it's like the ultimate offer for her. And so she says yes. And she heads to New Orleans at Dr. Oshner even sends her a bus ticket. And she gets on the bus and goes to New Orleans. So she's there a little bit early. It's a long story, but it's in the book. And she gets there, and now they have kind of a loose cannon on the deck because she's there early, and they're not quite ready for her. And so they need to, somebody to get a hold of her, and she needs a babysitter because she's 19 years old at this point. Okay, and she's now in big, bad, sin-sick New Orleans, all right? And they need somebody to, they've got a cover job set up for her, they've got an apartment for her, they've got to do all this stuff to get her into her position so that she can do her work in this secret laboratory that they have set up in David Ferry's apartment, okay? And they, in order to protect her and to manage her, they send in an ex-Marine who's got one foot in the mafia because he's from New Orleans. He's got one foot in the CIA because he's been trained. And his name is Lee Harvey Oswald. And Judith Berry Baker spends 5 months with Lee Oswald at her elbow in New Orleans. And what they're doing is they both have cover jobs at the Riley Coffee Company. They both start on May 10th. They both come from the same employment agency. And they go to work. They clock in. They act like they're working for a while, and then they disappear. And what they're doing most of the time is Judy is going over to, and Lee's going with her a lot, over to David Ferry's apartment. And across the street, they've got 2,000 mice in cages and managed by some Cuban kids. And the Cuban kids pick the mice with the big tumors, throw them in a cardboard box, bring them over to David Ferry's apartment. And Lee and Judy kill the mice with, like, formalin, and cut out the tumors, throw them in a blender, grind them up, put them in test tubes, prepare the slides, and all that stuff goes in a lunchbox. Then Judy cleans up the whole place to laboratory standards, puts everything away so it looks like a normal kitchen, and then she takes the lunchbox, goes and gets on the Louisiana Avenue bus, and takes it over to Mary Sherman's house, where she has a key to Mary Sherman's apartment. And she goes, lets herself in. A lot of the time she'd just sit there and read, but she drops off the material, and then she goes back to work to clock out. And Lee's running around doing all this stuff for Guy Bannister a lot of this time. And so she's clocking Lee out when she gets back there, too. So she's handling Lee Oswald's time cards. And we know this, and this is kind of interesting. There's a fairly famous document in the Warren Commission from Oswald's supposed supervisor who says, he was this horrible employee. I could never find him. He's off campus when he's supposed to be working and all this stuff. And I'm saying, well, if you're his supervisor and you think he's cheating the company by being off campus, why are you approving his time cards? The point is, that guy was not approving the time cards. The person who was approving Lee Oswald's time cards was Bill Moynihan, who's an ex-FBI agent who starts this propaganda, anti-communist propaganda organization with Alton Oshner. And when Moynihan is not around, Judith Berry Baker is approving Lee Oswald's time cards. Now, the importance of this is Warren Commission is famous, in fact, infamous for including all kind of irrelevant stuff in their 24 volumes of, quote, evidence, all right? Things like the x-rays of Jack Ruby's mother's teeth and things like that, dental records. If you're going to include that kind of stuff that doesn't really have any relevance to anything, then you ought to have Lee Oswald's time cards from the Riley Coffee Company in there. They actually have a list of his clock-in, clock-out times that Moynihan prepared, but they don't have his time cards. Why not? Because any competent investigator would take one look at those time cards and say, whose initials are these? Well, that's Judith Berry Baker's initial. Okay? So if they track down Judith Berry Baker, then they have to explain why this Wunderkind cancer researcher is working as a secretary at a coffee company with Lee Oswald. I mean, that is what they did not want to reveal. And today, in the new book, we have Lee Oswald's time cards with Judy's initial on it. Okay?
And let's take a break, Ed. We'll come back. We'll continue learning a little bit more about this and some of the newer information, why it was important to incorporate it in the new volume. Stay tuned. Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest this evening, Ed Haslam. Ed, you said for a fact that you know that this woman and Lee Harvey Oswald were going over doing this job. How do you know for a fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was involved in this part of the transaction as well, that that is, in fact, what he was doing when he was supposed to be clocked in?
Well, we have the personal testimony of Judith Berry Baker in her book, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, which is a 600-page, almost diary, of her involvement with cancer and with Lee Oswald. And I have researched this woman, vetted her as thoroughly as anybody could imagine. And I happen to live in the town that she grew up in. I can go to the library and look at all the microfilm with the medical, of the newspaper articles about her cancer research and all that. And I know this woman's background, and I know the woman, and her testimony is one of the planks on all this, because she was the resource that was brought in to weaponize the cancer, and they wind up testing this on a human. Well, I'll get to that part later on. Another time, I was doing a radio show, and a caller called in and asked me if I knew about the woman who lived in Mary Sherman's apartment building that knew Lee Oswald and saw him there. And I did, and her name is Victoria Hawes. And she was written about in a book by Joan Mellon on Jim Garrison, which I had read. And the caller says, well, I'm her husband's brother-in-law. Would you like me to put you in contact with these people? And I said, yes, okay. So I interviewed Victoria Hawes, and she had gone to middle school with Lee, and she was in 63, she was 21 years old. She had just had a baby. So she was a stay-at-home mom taking care of her baby. And there's a knock on the door. And she goes over and opens the door, and it's Lee Oswald. And he says, is Juan Valdez here? She says, hello, Lee, because she recognizes him. And he said, well, I'm looking for Juan Valdez. And she says, Juan lives in the next apartment building. And, next apartment. And there's only 13 apartments in this complex, and they're all focused on this courtyard, so everybody knows everybody very closely in there. So she sees Lee Oswald coming and going out of Juan Valdez's apartment repeatedly throughout the summer. And she says something really strange happens from Juan Valdez's apartment. She says, our bedroom shares a wall with Juan Valdez's bathroom. So every time he flushes the toilet, we hear the water running through the wall. And when Lee Oswald goes in there, they're flushing the toilet 25, 30 times in a row. I'm saying, wait a minute, how many times does this happen? Is this once or twice? And they said, no, this is every night for a month. So what's going on? They're disposing of something. What could they possibly be disposing of? Well, what about all this cancer stuff that Judy's bringing over in the test tubes to Mary Sherman's apartment? Okay? Lee Oswald, so I've got two witnesses, Victoria Hawes and Judith Berry Baker, who see Lee Oswald in the patio apartments where Mary Sherman lives during the summer of 1963. Therefore, when I look at the J. Edgar Hoover memo telling his agents not to investigate Mary Sherman's murder, I get really interested in this note on the second page. And this is in the new book, okay? And the note on the second page explains who Mary Sherman is, internationally renowned cancer researcher, blah, blah, blah. Right arm and rib cage burned off. Next sentence, somebody's name was found in her address book, and somebody's name is redacted. And somebody's name happens to be six letters long, which happens to be the same length as Oswald's name. And there's no first name in here. So they're telling the head of the FBI, hey, boss, look what we found. okay? The NOPD had asked the FBI for help and told them they found this name in Mary Sherman's address book, and the name is redacted. So I'm saying I shouldn't be guessing about this. I mean, if that's Oswald's name, we need to know. So I contact the FBI, Freedom of Information, JFK Records Act, all this stuff. I said, I know you guys are busy, but all I need is one word. One word, okay? I need to know what that name is. And they said, we're not telling you. Appeal to the Department of Justice. And so I do all the forms. I appeal to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice tells me, we don't have to tell you, and we're not going to tell you. Okay? So we're told we have this new openness. We're told we have JFK Records Act. We're told we have Freedom of Information. And when I try to get one word out of them from a memo that was written 50 years ago, they won't tell me. So something's going on with this word, all right? And so I put that in the book. And then the other question that I get a lot is, well, we know the CIA was working with the mafia trying to kill Castro, but were they involved in this particular laboratory? Was this an official project? Well, right after I came out with my book in 2007, the CIA held a big press conference, and the director of the CIA said, it's time to unveil the family jewels, right? The family jewels is the name of a document that the CIA created around the time of the Watergate thing, which said, what did the CIA do between 1958 and 1964, this exact little window that we're talking about here, that was either illegal or embarrassing to the agency, that the agency's director needed to know about so he didn't lie to Congress or misstate things? Well, when they show this, there are eight jewels there. And we can see what 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are. But jewel number one is 100% redacted. That's 3 pages of text and the entire summary. I mean, there's not a V or an and or a but in there. I mean, there's nothing. There's something the CIA did right at this point in time that they are unwilling to tell the American people about. And one of the things I learned when we tracked down the guy that installed the linear particle accelerator was that normally when he would install one, there would be something like a mortgage that would be paid off over 20 years because these were really expensive machines. I mean, $10 million back then be like $100 million today, okay? So he said, the one in New Orleans, he got 6 different checks within a week from 6 different banks of different amounts. Well, that's money laundering. And that's money laundering by somebody that's got a lot of money. Okay? So the question that I have is, did the CIA use its money laundering operation to finance the linear particle accelerator at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital because they were told that this was a national emergency having to do with the contamination of the polio vaccine? And that's what they don't want to tell the public. Now,
couldn't it be 6 to 8 different investors that want to make these donations for that particle accelerator and make those contributions themselves? We'll talk more with Ed Haslam. Dr. Mary's Monkey is the name of the book. You can spell it out, drmarysmonkey.com, to visit his website for more information. Stay tuned. Coast to Coast AM continues right after this.